Hey folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Greetings and thanks for being here for another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture. We are talking about the weather. Not really, because you know what? If you want to talk about the weather, go down to the local diner where the old farmers hang out and you'll get more weather than you can stand. We're actually talking about big picture stuff, climatological changes, and most importantly, the coming season as it will be impacted by a third year of La Nina. Okay, I've got somebody that knows way more about this than me. He's a pal of mine from the speaking circuit. It's not really a circuit. We say that. We bump into each other at conferences where we are both speaking. His name is Eric Snodgrass, meteorologist and atmospheric scientist. He's a senior science fellow working on behalf of Nutrien. So he goes around to agricultural conferences all over North America like I do, except for he's getting paid to do it by Nutrien for all of those things and sometimes not when he does freelance stuff. We bump into each other. He's been on this show before. I thought he'd be a great interview. Mr. Snodgrass, Professor Snodgrass, Dr. Snodgrass, senior science fellow man Snodgrass. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, you can just call me Chubby Dad who forecasts the weather. That works too. So,
yeah, and you don't really forecast the weather. I think that we should probably just put this out there right now, what the viewer and listener is going to find. We're going to talk about big picture stuff as this La Nina pattern and some of the other influences are impacting our weather and what we think it might mean or what you think and what my read is and what that'll mean for the business of agriculture, say in the next 6 to 18 months. But, you know, the weatherman that's on Channel 8 has a completely different thing than you do. You don't say, hey, it looks like it's going to be windy with some storms approaching tonight. You're doing big picture stuff. You look at climatological models. You do a great job of seeing you on stage. And you, in August, we both were at a conference. You said, we had a second year of La Nina, and here's what that has meant. And boom, everything you said happened or was going to happen, happened. You said we might really have some struggles if we have a third La Nina year pattern. So I guess let's start at the beginning, man. What do you do? And then let's get into what La Nina is.
Yeah. So my main goal at Nutrien and what I spend my most time trying to figure out is assessing risk. It's like you. I mean, I'm out there trying to understand what are the things that could affect the bottom line of any grower. And a lot of times, you know, yeah, the weather impacts your operations, but the weather tends to impact bigger things we do, like everything from fertilizer to diesel prices to, you know, to when you plant, when you harvest, and then in between, the markets look at all of that and fluctuate like mad. So I try to understand that level of the weather. It's kind of funny, you know, every morning my kids wake up and they never ask me what the weather's going to be around here today, because I don't care. Like I don't focus on the, oh, in Champaign, Illinois today, it's going to be whatever. I'm like, well, ask me what the weather's doing this winter. Let's talk about South America, or let's, you know, then we can have a conversation. I said, just go ask the smart speaker.
The cobbler's kid ain't got no shoes. The doctor's kid is always sick. And then the weatherman's kids don't know whether they should wear a scarf or not, because you don't know to go and get on the school bus. So anyway, yeah, you do big picture stuff and I like it. You're not technically a PhD. You did teach at the college level, and that's what brought you to Champaign, right? At University of Illinois. And your thing has always been, let's talk about what satellite imagery tells us. But again, not to tell us that there's going to be a storm front moving through the Dakotas. More like what might be coming 3 months from now. There's probably people that say, you know what? You can't tell me if it's going to be raining on Thursday. Bullshit. You don't know what this whole satellite thing says is going to happen 3 months from now. How do you answer that?
Well, you know, that's actually why I never finished my PhD. So what happened is I was working on it, did all my coursework, and I started to discover through the process of working on my PhD that the applied meteorology side of things was fascinating. So I sold it. I sold my dissertation topic to my first client. So you can't publish it after that. So that's why. But it was all about what you were asking about. It's all this sub-seasonal to seasonal weather forecasting. And you're attempting to not predict like, oh, we're going to have a blizzard in North Dakota. We just had one. Yeah, that's easy to talk about. It's like, all right, how many more of those are you going to have this winter? What's the soil moisture going to look like when it's all said and done? Does California recover from a drought? Does the whole drought area in the United States shrink between now, you know, here in November, and by the time we get to next April? What about Europe? Do they have major energy demand from cold snaps? And oh yeah, Australia's flooding. There's a drought in Argentina, and Brazil just had its fastest plant in a long time. I got to look at all those things. And that's what I spend my days doing, is coming up with ways by which to do that, both with just my old brain and some of my colleagues I talked to, but also develop a ton of software to help me keep eyes on all of it. And yeah, it's fascinating. And I love teaching at the U of I. I taught there for 16 years, taught over 25,000 kids, had a blast. But this is a new fun adventure that I'm on now.
It's a new adventure, and Nutrien has you go around and talk at these conferences. And obviously, weather is the one of the biggest impacts on agricultural production, no matter where you are, from Australia to here. So it's kind of a cool thing. I liked when I saw you in August, you put up some images, and then you said, and every time we've ever seen this, here's what we can usually expect. So then it becomes, oh, of course, the predictive analysis is, seven times in the last 20 years, we've seen X. And when we see X, we see a resulting Y. So then it's like, oh, this isn't just some, pulling some hair out of your ass kind of a thing. You're actually
there's a little bit of that.
There's a little bit of that. Yeah. You're actually saying, all right, I got this. So like, let's talk about the La Nina thing, because you're a big person about patterns and past, and and predictive analysis is, when we've seen this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, it's resulted in this. And so you said La Nina, first off, what is it? And then why it's so rare that we'd have it 3 years in a row. I think that's the biggie, but go ahead and what is La Nina?
Yeah, so where we live here in North America, our prevailing wind direction's out of the west, right? We have the westerlies. All of our weather systems come mostly from the west and head on off to the east. Well, you go north or south of where we are. So go to the poles or to the tropics, the winds come out of the other direction, that come out of the east. So the tropics have this wind belt called the trade winds that runs all the way around the equator. And this is what happens. For some reason, and I really have to say it that way because we don't fully know why, but for some reason, every so often, those trade winds pick up just a bunch of extra momentum. They go fast. And if they start really going fast, the ocean temperatures begin to respond. And what we do is we watch the Pacific between, Australia and South America. And when those trade winds are scooting along there, a bunch of cold water shows up. It upwells. It just gets pulled up. All right. Well, the ocean temperatures are the symptom. The wind pattern change is the cause. And what happens is when those trade winds get going fast on the equator, they tend to steal the momentum from our westerlies. So in summer, 6 in 10 years that's happening. So 6 out of 10 times, we end up having drought that builds in the Midwest. We have drought that builds in the plains. In the winter, it tends to give us cold winters, snowy winters. It tends to give us, one of those winters that folks remember. Now, that's just kind of the general pattern. And certainly last year, we had a strong one this past summer. And we saw, massive drought from Texas all the way up to Nebraska. It's creeped into the Western Corn Belt. It hit Indiana, it hit your home state, it hit my home state of Illinois. And we just had these patchy drought problems that kept-
You're talking about summer. Drought. We're recording this November 2022. You're talking summer, like June, like 5 to 6 months ago.
This recent pattern. Yeah. And again, need to be blamed on it.
I want to bring this back here, because the person that's driving down the road and doing her ag sales job is listening to this. The equatorial winds, the trade winds, are going the wrong direction, the different direction than ours, and they get faster. We don't know
That's why. And when that happens,
it changes what our winds do.
Yep.
Now, we were still very windy this year.
Well, I'm talking about winds at the jet stream level in summer. Now, spring was crazy windy, and that was when this La Nina was building. So it reached a peak in summer through fall. But in summertime, whenever you have a La Nina, so the whole planet's trying to conserve its It's net momentum. So if you build it up somewhere, it's got to come from somewhere else.
Yep.
So if it builds up on the equator, it's pulled from the mid latitudes where we live. And that's what sent us into this drought. I mean, it hit the Mississippi River hard. We're still looking at water levels in the Mississippi, like Memphis, that are 12 feet below where they should, below low stage. That's going to be a problem going forward and everything.
What you're talking about, I think, is really interesting. When I just said, hey, it was still windy. And you said, we're talking about winds at winds at 30,000 feet.
Right.
Yeah. Winds that we don't even, we only know about them if we're on an airplane and we're getting the shit bounced out of us like you and I do sometimes. So we're not really talking about the winds down here. So that changes. And the La Nina means then the temperature of the Pacific Ocean changes. And you would say, that's a huge ocean. It's like one third of the planet. And you're telling me some winds, 30,000 feet change the temperature of the ocean that's one third of the planet or one fourth of the planet. That's how big the Pacific is. That seems crazy to me.
Yeah, it is. They're so persistent that across the equatorial Pacific, it's actually the lowest, probably 2 to 3 miles in the atmosphere, just keep pushing the strong winds toward Australia. And what happens is that gets the ocean turning over. Let's see, it just gets the water to turn over, brings up all that cold water, and there you've got it. So we look for that cold water. That's the symptom that says, in fact, I'm looking at a map of it right over here on my other screen. Like, that's the symptom that says, hey, we're going to have issues with getting the flow to be, well, better, more out of the west, giving us more systems leading to drought in the lower 48.
Well, I hope you're not multitasking. When you said you're looking at another screen right now, I want to know that you're fully devoted, Mr. Professor Snodgrass, to my people right here. Okay. Answer me this then. So the Pacific Ocean gets colder, and then is that what changes our weather in North America? Or is it that and the wind? Or is it that the wind and some other thing? Don't know, kind of know.
Yeah. So in the very background of it, it's all about the wind. The ocean temperatures, as they change, are the symptom of what the wind is doing. Then they start to positively feed back on one another. So because they went over cold, the winds actually tend to have a stronger, well, there's some kinematic change. So they get going faster. And because of that, they get colder and colder and colder. And then, so it feeds back on itself until something breaks it. And so what my job is try to figure out what's going to break it and when it's going to break. And are we going to complete this third year of La Nina that we've already started? And I'll be honest with you, and we're going to talk about this, but I don't see us finishing a third year of La Nina at this point. We started it back in when we were talking in August. Will it carry all the way through next summer? I think it'll be gone by the time we're talking in spring.
Okay. And what it means is, generally, and the way you mapped it out, and I thought, man, every single one of those things happened. Now, granted, it's kind of like when you're the prognosticator, it's always easy to prognosticate in hindsight.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The truth is, but you said what we can expect in North America when we have a La Nina pattern, colder ocean, these winds change. And then you taught me something about clear up in the Bering Sea, up where the Pacific Ocean goes clear up and gets up there outside of Alaska. When something happens there, it means something down here. Remind me of that.
Well, I mean, that would be so.
Are you impressed that I remember what
I am? In fact, that's what I was sitting here thinking. I'm like, holy crap, how did he remember that from August? But yeah. So when we look for something to trigger a change in the pattern, all right, it's going to come out of the North Pacific for us, usually. So what's going to happen is if we start to see the jet stream just kick up and get screaming out of the Bering Sea, across the Aleutian Islands, into the Gulf of Alaska, that just keeps going east and barrels across the United States. And why we watch the Bering Sea so carefully is because you got a bunch of warm water comes up from the Pacific and it meets the Arctic. And we call that, here's a fun new word for you, we call that a baroclinic zone. That just means where the winds are crisscrossing the temperature pattern, and that's a recipe for getting the atmosphere to spin. And it will just kick systems off and they just move to the east because of that. So yeah, I'll be honest with you, if you want to do better at forecasting the weather in the Midwest, for example, quit looking at the Midwest, go look at the West Coast, look at the Bering Sea, look at Alaska. Everything that we're going to see here will be born out of that region, and it'll move here. So let me give you a case in point. You ready? It's brutally cold right now across the U.S. We just had a blizzard that went through. Our temperatures dropped over 50 degrees in Iowa. They're dropping in Illinois like a rock this morning. And it's going to be cold through Thanksgiving. You know what's going on in the Bering Sea? Whole bunch of heat just pushed through it, and it's up in Alaska. In fact, it made its way all the way over to Scandinavia. They're kind of linked, this cross-polar heat. And guess what? If it's hot there, it can't be hot here. So that, you want to know when it's going to change? Watch the Bering Sea. If it changes there, we'll see the result.
I like it. And by the way, dear listener, if you happen to be driving your car in Nebraska right now doing your job, and you're like, hey, remind me, I don't want to sound stupid, I will be the one that holds my hands up and ask the question, I don't know where the Bering Sea is. This is the area that's to the west and south of Alaska. Basically, if you think about it, Alaska kind of is above and then comes down along the top edge of Canada, and that's the Bering Sea. And also, it's where that whole Pacific Ocean goes up there and just kind of churns around. It sounds like what I'm hearing. You said it's getting really cold in the U.S. Now, you did a weather-specific thing right there, Eric. It's cold where you are. You're over there wearing your hoodie, doing your best doing your best Senator Fetterman impression. But the thing is, it's not that cold here yet. Today's the day here in Indiana, so we're going to get your weather tomorrow. We're starting to fall off a cliff, and we're going to be like 72 yesterday and 40 on Saturday. It's happening all, but you said that all came from the Northwest. One thing that you said in our your August presentation was when we have a La Nina pattern, we then have this drying and drought stuff. And then you talked about something happening, which we did. We were dry, certainly terribly dry west of the river, kind of dry here where you and I are, but we still made close to record crops because we just had some fortunate rains. But then that strata in like Texas, Arkansas, and all that, you talked about that strata in there. What? Why is it different there, and what did the La Nina mean to them?
Yeah, so the problem they had this year is that we have a thing called the rain shadow. So in other words, you find the Rocky Mountains and start heading east, and normally the extent of the rain shadow begins to break off at about the 100th meridian, right in the smack dab in the middle of the country. This year, we saw that whole drought zone just keep moving east. And by the time we got in the middle of summer, giant dome of high pressure set over Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, which still are having problems with the winter wheat crop right now, and Texas. So they had in some places there 50 plus days of high temperatures above 100. They had no rainfall that zapped all the moisture from the soil, pulled it out of the Arkansas River, the Red River of the South, anything that feeds into the Mississippi, and it decimated crops. So this didn't hit corn and soybeans. It hit sorghum. It hit rice. It hit wheat. It hit everything that's grown in that particular area, cotton. And it was just one of those things where the ridge just got there, sat there, and didn't move. And as a result of that, they absolutely baked.
And so that zone is roughly Kansas to the north, south to somewhere in Texas, certainly Arkansas, parts of Louisiana, the mid to not completely deep south, right? It's more what we call the mid-south. Memphis calls itself the capital of the mid-south. Through there, all the way across, and it was exceedingly high temperatures. And they've always been hot, but Jesus, it was really hot this time, and then also no rain. Will that be what we predict every year that there's a La Nina pattern out in the Pacific?
No, and that's a great thing to bring up. Every La Nina has a different flavor. This particular one had its greatest influence on the far western side of the Pacific. And when that tends to happen, you tend to have more drought in the southern plains. If you have it more in the central Pacific or east Pacific, the drought tends to be farther north in the northern plains and in the Midwest. So it's all just depends on where those trade winds, where the nose of them likes to sit. And this year it was clear over to almost into Indonesia for this summer.
So if we ended up being, as you said, central or eastern Pacific, people like you in central Illinois or me in northern Indiana, we might get whacked, and it may not be good for us at all, because we were the places that had some dryness, but we held up, and we're bumping the yields compared to what happened west of the river. And we could actually have some food supply issues if we have this too widespread.
It could. And so that's why I think probably the most important thing to think about is, what does the drought picture look like from now to April? And does La Nina actually stick around, or does something with it start to fade and break? And those trade winds, they, instead of screaming, they slow down and the warm water comes back and everything is, you know, the issue with it is this: when you lose La Nina, historically, we never just like lose it and everything goes back to normal.
Right.
The atmosphere loves to overshoot. So I'll be honest with you, there is some evidence right now that by next summer, we could be talking El Nino, the complete opposite phase, changing in about 7 or 8 months, just complete flip flop, which is why I keep getting paid. People, you know, something new to talk about.
First off, I like you getting paid, and I want to hear about what a flip flop of the La Nina means. Before we do that, I want to tell our listeners and our viewers about the information issue. You know, farmers spend 19% of their time looking for information. And you may not believe that number, but that's a number that was brought up by my friend Rob Syke, who's the founder of AgVisor Pro. AgVisor Pro is an app on your phone. I'm just pulling it up right here. It essentially is a platform to get information, to shorten distance and time. So if you need information and you need an answer to a question, you can go on Ag Twitter and then ask the question and be ridiculed by all the know-it-all dumbasses on Twitter that think they're all geniuses because they drive around, you know, spitting in their spit cup, talking about how smart they are. Or you can actually find someone that is an expert that does know what they're talking about. You can do that on AgVisor Pro. It's an app on your phone. It costs you nothing. Now, if you end up deciding to do business with somebody you meet on AgVisor Pro, they may charge you for this information. They may end up being your consultant. And the best part, you could be that person as well. It is an information exchange and expert networking format, if you will, on your phone. So you want to go and humiliate it on Twitter? Ask your question or find somebody that actually knows. Go to AgVisor Pro. Snap on your phone. All right. A flipping of the La Nina pattern, Professor Snodgrass, that could mean anything, which is good in your business. It means, hey, we're not sure what might happen, but just be prepared. Have a rain jacket and also have a snow coat. Have this, have that, have a snow blower, also have a, but we don't know. And right. I guess, what's your best guess? A third year in a row, you're saying the one guess you have is it won't last throughout the year, meaning it's not likely that we'll have this June and July and August thing like we did this year, right?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, usually what happens when we end up breaking away from a La Nina is that instead of during winter, the flow just relentlessly coming out of the Northwest, it starts to shift and come out of the Southwest. Now, everybody in the country wants this right now, because if you get flow coming from Hawaii to California, California to Maine, that delivers moisture. California breaks their drought. The Central Plains breaks their drought. Even the pockets of drought that are still throughout the East will start to shrink. So what happens is the jet stream, whenever there is a breakaway from La Nina, it just splits into two pieces. We just tend to get better overall flow. Now, this fading of La Nina, I've been looking at it now for about 2.5 months, trying to figure out when and where and what. And I think that the thing that'll be critical will be just right after Christmas. I think we'll start to see for the first 15 days of the new year and maybe the last day of this old year, that will be when the trade winds will start to advertise that they're going to not maintain their strength. And if that occurs, then we'll start to see the outcome of that shift, you know, in the following months. Now, there's actually not a single global model out there today that is predicting La Nina to last all the way through spring next year. They've all faded away on it. And, you know, there's good evidence that it could happen. If that does happen, historically, we correlate El Nino, with summer. Nino,
real quickly, they're both Spanish words.
Yep.
I remember we didn't hear about El Nino until about 25 years ago. It became, the world got obsessed with El Nino talk.
Yeah.
And El Nino means the baby, because Spanish fishermen or something associated weather patterns with Christmas, which means the time of the baby Jesus. And that's where El Nino got his name. Am I right?
That's right. Yeah. El Nino is always capitalized. It's in reference to Jesus. That's right. Now, La Nina is just what scientists call the opposite of El Nino. So when you have an El Nino, those trade winds are almost gone. The warm water sloshes back, and guess who gets the momentum? The jet stream where we live. So you see, if you got momentum in our flow, then systems roll through and they keep rolling through and we get a lot of precipitation. So honestly, the last time we saw that was 17, 18, and 19. And you know how wet some of those springs were when we had an El Nino. So I don't like that. I don't want to see tight spring planting windows, but at least it is a better flavor than talking about drought and drought expansion and drought risk early.
Yeah, neither too much water nor too little is good. But you know, drought years you can get a hell of a lot done. That's the one thing. You can get a lot of work done. It may not come to fruition because there's no water, but you can get a lot of work done. What about then the West? You know, California's a screwed up mess. And I know I got listeners out there, and the people that are listeners, they know California's a screwed up mess. It's not because of our ag people out there. It's because of what happened in Sacramento and various other activist groups. They're dry. And all the people carrying around signs that it's the end of the world, we need electric cars, isn't going to change that. We really do have a dry situation there. As much as they might say it's climate change or we need to put electric cars on the road, isn't it really that it's been a abnormal pattern for like a decade or more that's been affecting the West? And you talked a little bit about that in August.
Yeah. So California has what we call a Mediterranean climate. So that means that from April to October, it's dry. And then from October to April, it tends to be wet, which means if you don't get the moisture from October to April, then you won't recover it throughout the rest of the year, which means their drought situation tends to last years. Ours doesn't, right? In the Midwest, if we have a drought, it's 6 to 9 months and gone. And then we're on to something new. But out West, it's different. So yeah, we have, of course, we have issues with water in the West. In fact, I just read two good books about it. One's called Cadillac Desert and the other one's called Where the Water Goes. Both just fantastic books to understand it. But right now, Lake Shasta, big reservoir in Northern California, is at 30% full pool. Normally at this point in the year, it's about 60% full pool. Oroville is the same thing. Another massive reservoir. It's about 30%, should be 60. We need to have 2 winters worth of snowfall in the Sierra Nevada to get those back up to where they can go through next year without major water issues.
Didn't we have a big snowpack the winter 7 months ago, 8 months ago in the high country of the California?
Not in California. So in California, it was very low snowpack. They didn't get any really from January to March. Where the snow was in the Cascades in Northern Rockies. Because that's where the jet stream was. It just,
and so, I mean, there was, and that means like Washington State. And,
yeah, that's and, Columbia River. That's Snake River Valley. That's not Central Valley of California. That was the problem. So California was robbed to pay the Northwest when it comes to the jet stream flow last year.
All right, we promised we were going to tell people what a third year, what a third year of La Nina means, and maybe we don't completely know, but and we're not going to put you on, we're not going to hold you accountable if our
you
if
should.
Our... All right, so we're recording. You and I are recording this in November. So what do you guess? What's your best educated guess on the models and the satellites and the images that you're seeing? You already said you don't think La Nina persists through all of 2023. It looks like it's going to be there for the beginning part of it.
Yeah.
The poor guys like my buddy Matt Miles, who's with Extreme Ag down in the Delta region of Arkansas, is like, you know, we're always hot, but for God's sakes, you know, we're talking about heat index still hanging around 103 at midnight. And, you know, he says, Your plants is like a great athlete can go out and perform on a hot day, but let the athlete get some rest and recuperation at night. You see, my plants never got rest and recuperation at night because of those conditions. That was not just in the Delta region of Arkansas. It was a whole bunch of the United States because of this holding pattern of dry and hot. Do you predict that again in 23?
Right now, I don't, to be honest with you. I think that we will see if there's a transition of La Nina, it's going to be a situation where instead of having widespread state level drought, we have every summer pockets of drought that show up because our summer precipitation is driven by storms and they're hit or miss by their very nature. Yeah. But I don't see it at this point. I actually think that once we get into the new year, we could see maybe upwards of a 20%+ reduction in how much of the country is currently in drought. We're currently at 85%. I don't see that being the case. But you're the telltale, the thing that you know that could set up 2023 to be a much better year for water is if all throughout winter, I'm talking about California's Sierra Nevada mountains packing up with snow, because that means the jet stream's entering there. It comes out in the plains. It moves across the Midwest. It finishes in New York. And you want that. You just want this jet stream flow to scream across the country. And it makes for a rotten winter. I mean, we just tend to have repeated systems. There's snow, there's rain, freezing. I don't care. All I care about is what gets into that soil. And if there's moisture there in April, that's key to the success of the next season.
Well, I like the song you're singing right now, Professor, because we are here in northern Indiana, where I am, exceedingly dry. We made our crops because of some timely rains and whatnot. We made some really good crops. But it is November, in mid-November, when you and I are recording this, and, you know, there's just nothing down a foot or 2 feet or 3 feet. Yeah. And so we, and a lot of people that are listening to this that are in ag, but they're not really soils types, don't realize you need that half an inch of rain and let it get permeate. And you need that snowpack then to slowly melt in. You build that reservoir so that you have moisture down 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot, because that's the moisture you're going to again come the dry spell we get next August, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's building that profile up and, you know, where you and I live, we've got deep topsoil. So there's plenty out there to hold that moisture. And that was probably what helped us sustain through the really dry. I mean, right here in Champaign County, where I live, we were in D4 drought. Yet there's already over here at this elevator, just on the roof of my house, they're already building what my kids call the corn cano. This is, you know, the giant piles outside of the corn. I know it was a good year here.
Yeah, it's a good year, but we do need the moisture. So if we have that kind of a winter, we replenish a lot of what was taken from us. And like you said, the Mississippi River, climatologically and historically, have we seen the river? You're in your 40s. 50 almost, aren't you?
Nah, early 40s. Come on.
Okay, early 40s. Have we seen the Mississippi River this depleted in the last 30 years?
Yeah, it's gotten low before. Where we are currently with the river, though, is some of the lowest in the last 40 years. So, you know, usually every October, the river's down. That's normal. I mean, we typically just have dry falls around here. And that river is it's made to move, right? I mean, it's been engineered over the last century to move water. So it becomes a bit more susceptible to drought. But where it currently is compared to all those historical years, it's about 4 to 5 feet lower than in the past. And that makes all the difference, because now all of a sudden you start to bring these sandbars, which are not usually a problem, into play. And I've seen too many videos of barges hitting the banks trying to stay in the deep channel. And that's a problem. So I got asked, how can we get the river back up by the first of the year? And I'm like, to get the river back up by the first of the year, you have to have a repeat of fall and early winter of 2015. And if you remember that one, I know it was a while ago, but the river was down about 5 feet higher than it currently is, but it was down. And we had the wettest fall on record and the wettest start to winter on record. And the river was back up to 32 feet by January 1. And so you have to flood to get there.
Yeah, I was saying, that might be fine for river and barge traffic, which means moving our grain and our fertilizer. But if you happen to have crops still in the field, you're screwed, because once it started raining that year, it didn't stop. And so you took a loss, or you insured. Closing thoughts. We're looking at the year ahead. The year that was, take away from the year that was that makes you a better climatological atmospheric scientist when you look at what's going on. What did this year teach you that you can share with us?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I really learned this year is that, you know, we had all predicted a very active hurricane season. That was one of the big misses we had this year. And what I really needed to remember here is that it's not just one thing that drives a hurricane season. I tend to just focus a lot on, are the oceans warm enough? And then what's the wind shear doing? Because wind shear can rip apart a hurricane with no trouble. This year, you know, I needed to be reminded that you can get really dry, dusty air from the Sahara all the way across the Atlantic, and it can shut these things down at the wrong time of year. That was a miss. You know, we were expecting 150 to 180% of normal on hurricanes. I know Nicole just went through, that brought us up to an average year technically on the number of names, but we're about 25% off on the total accumulated cycle.
And by the way, the climate alarmists, every time there's a hurricane, says, see, that's why we need electric cars. And I know you don't get political in your job, but I can because it's my podcast. We had Hurricane Ian, and we had this one that's hitting now, Nicole, and you know, the politicians would go on and talk about, that's why we need more windmills. This is not anything out of the ordinary. For 130 years of keeping track of this, we usually have a few hurricanes per year make landfall in the U.S., right?
Yeah, I think the thing that is often missed in that discussion is that over those 100 years, the places where hurricanes hit, so from Texas to Florida and up the East Coast, we have seen massive development, right? I mean, there's more people, there's more infrastructure. So when a hurricane hits, it automatically does more damage. Plus, the agricultural land that's down there is prime. So what happens now is that when they hit, we do hear so much more about them because of how quick it is to just get information out there. But yeah, I'm not being political when I say this, but everybody knows when we hear those narratives, put a good filter on your ears. And if you got a question about hurricanes and climate, ask me. I will gladly tell you what the science currently knows and understands and give it to you in a way that's digestible and easy to get. But
So big takeaways were, we didn't have the hurricane outbreaks that you anticipated. You said something about dust. And the issue on that was what?
That came off the Sahara. We had dust from the Sahara make it all the way to the southeast.
Okay, now that's remarkable. So we're talking about winds that I can't comprehend. And then the other one is, your big takeaway is for people that are kind of concerned, saying, man, this thing that happened this year, if that was La Nina, I don't want another one. And you're saying, chances are we're going to be okay in terms of we're not going to have this scorching heat and dry that we had.
Yeah, I'm fully prepared to be wrong. I'm an atmospheric scientist. That's my day job, right? Is to be prepared to be wrong. But all I do is I look for evidence. And if you have evidence that suggests something might happen, well, I'll tell you about it. And I think right now this La Nina starts its third year. It already did. I just don't think it completes it. And that is good news for the United States in terms of drought. That's very good news.
His name's Eric Snodgrass. He is a meteorologist, atmospheric scientist, senior science fellow for Nutrien. He's also one of my favorite people to bump into on the road at these speaking engagements at agricultural conferences all over North America, because he always has interesting stuff to say. And then I know, since we're buddies, I can get a word in edgewise. After he gets done and walks off stage, farm types swarm him. I mean, it's like Elvis, for God's sake, swarm.
They do that to you too. So sometimes I got to beat them off of you so I can have a conversation.
They come to me because I'm funny, or they think they want to agree with one of my edgy points. They come up to you because they like sit at your feet like the disciple of Jesus is like, oh, what's he going to say next? Am I going to get rain at my farm in Kansas?
Well, anyway,
they want to find you. How do they find you?
You know, probably the easiest way is just via YouTube. We got a great channel we put all our content out on. If you just Google or get on YouTube, search Nutrien Ag Solutions, you'll find it there. I can even get y'all access to my morning reports if you want them. I wake up every day trying to figure out what the next steps are going to be, fully prepared to be humbled by the atmosphere. It's good at doing that. But, you know, over time, you learn from those errors and you start to get just better at making fewer errors. And that's what you and I do, right? We try to look out there as far as we can and make the assessment based on history and what we've learned. I love the fact that people want to hear what we have to say. That's a good feeling. Man,
it's great. And I like it too. Also, you know what? I'm going to sign up for your morning newsletter. I hadn't even thought.
Yeah.
All right. His name's Eric Snodgrass. My name's Damian Mason. Go to the YouTube and type in, what did they type in? Nutrien
Ag Solutions, and you'll find it. Yep.
Nutrien Ag Solutions. Yep. And look for the Eric Snodgrass climatological information. It's immediate. Yep. It's fascinating. All right. Till next time. I really appreciate being here, man.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Till next time. I'm Damian Mason, and this is The Business of Agriculture. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right. Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.